Hi folks, Oisin here. Just a short update, everything is going well with the podcast so far. I just wanted to say thanks again for all the donations, reviews, emails and messages. Your support has been amazing and I'm glad that you have all found this podcast to be helpful. For many in Northern Ireland who lived through these very violent and tragic years, the Troubles are something many would rather forget. But for people around the world, it is an important part of history that needs to be told. As always, you can support the podcast at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast or by buying me a virtual coffee at buymeacoffee.com/troublespodcast. Before we start, I want to talk about another podcast. Small Town Dicks is a true crime podcast hosted by Yardley Smith, the voice of Lisa Simpson, and Dan and Dave, who are identical twin detectives from Small Town, USA. Each episode features an investigation from a small town in America and is told by the detective who investigated it. 911 calls and suspect interviews bring these first-hand accounts to life, as well as shine a light on the fact that the violent crimes committed in these modest communities are no less depraved and vicious than they are in the big cities. They just happen with slightly less frequency. As fellow detectives, Dan and Dave anchor the show, while Yardley asks the questions that you would ask them if you had a seat at their table. Don't miss the thrilling new season of Small Town Dicks, available on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the show.
I have never been afraid to die, and no one knows that better than the IRA. But there are many forms of death, and many ways to die. And these past few years have been a living hell to me. And let me say, not because I am opposed to peace, for I am not. Nor am I opposed to conflict resolution. But because I'm living through the death of our nation, the destruction of our way of life, I'm sick of ambiguity. I'm sick of the government's lies and deceit. I will not become part of a process that's designed to ease our people into a united Ireland.
Billy Wright has become one of the most prominent loyalist icons in the history of the Troubles. Some people remember him as a cult hero, a martyr for the cause of loyalism. Others remember him as a cold-blooded killer who struck fear in the hearts of the people of Northern Ireland. This episode will focus on his life and his prominence during the Troubles. This is the Troubles podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. William Stephen Wright was born on July 7, 1960, in Wolverhampton, England. His father was originally from Portadown, Armagh, but had moved over to England for work. Wright was one of five and had four sisters. Back in Portadown, the Wright family were well known as Billy's grandfather had been elected to the local council there. In the 1940s, his grandfather campaigned against the discrimination which was going on against Catholics when it came to housing and employment, and found himself clashing with the Orange Order and the Ulster Unionist Party, a sentiment that he would pass down to Billy two generations later. At an early age, Billy's parents split up and he moved to the village of Mount Norris, which was in a significantly more Republican area than Portadown, which was considered a Unionist stronghold. In school there, Wright learned all about Irish history, culture and heritage. He received an education that many Protestant children at the time wouldn't have got, and learned the Irish version of Irish history, instead of learning the anglicised one. His upbringing meant that he had many Catholic friends, as well as Protestant ones, and there were days he'd walk with his friends to the local pitch and watch the GAA games taking place. For a man that would eventually become as feared as the Shankill Butchers, Wright's upbringing was very different from most hardline loyalists, and many would refuse to watch Irish GAA games, arguing that it's related to the IRA and republicanism. At the age of 15, Wright moved back to Portadown, and this is where things started to change for him. He had seen how the IRA had been attacking Unionist soldiers, and by 1975, the violence was starting to intensify. There would also have been plenty of recruiters on the prowl in Portadown, looking for young men who they could train in as paramilitary fighters. On the 31st of July, 1975, which was the night that the Miami Show Band were killed, Wright was sworn in to the Young Citizens Volunteers, which was the youth wing of the paramilitary organisation, the Ulster Volunteer Force, or UVF for short. Journalist David McKittrick in the Belfast Telegraph described Wright as being heavily tattooed, who walked with a characteristic strut that radiated restrained menace, and he had a bullet head, close cropped, with small ears and deep-set piercing eyes. The same year Wright was sworn in, he was also arrested by the police and charged with possession of firearms. He claims that he was beaten in police custody and forced to sign a number of confessions, stating that he was a member of a number of paramilitary organisations. For this, he was sentenced to 6 years behind bars. This sentence was to take place in HMS Mays Prison, and Wright was in the Young Persons Wing, which was for offenders under the age of 21. In 1976, the blanket protests began, where Republican prisoners refused to wear their prison uniforms, arguing that they were prisoners of war and not regular prisoners. These protests eventually led to the hunger strikes in 1981, which will be covered in this season. Wright initially joined in the blanket protests as he also didn't want to be treated as a regular criminal, arguing that he was only imprisoned because of his political beliefs. But he was soon ordered to give up on the blanket protest by senior members of the UVF, as it made it look like he was siding with and supporting the Republican prisoners. Soon after this, 17-year-old Wright was promoted to wing commander, and he served out the rest of his time in close proximity to Republican prisoners, one of which had been taking part in the blanket protest. Martin Dillon writes in his book, The Wright Boy, The Life and Death of LVF Leader Billy Wright, that Wright remembers that the man hadn't washed in over a year, and recalls the smell and appearance of the man. Quote, I knew the significance of what I was witnessing. If here was a movement that would inflict on itself so much violence for its own ideology, then what would it not do to other human beings? I knew then it had to be resisted. Wright was released in 1982, but his anger had deepened, and in particular he hated the British government and blamed them for failing to protect the Northern Irish Protestants from Irish Republicans. He initially tried to get away from Northern Ireland and moved to Scotland, where he worked in a hotel, but he was soon arrested by Scottish authorities and essentially banned from Great Britain and deported back to Northern Ireland. During this time, he was in a relationship with Thelma Corrigan, whose father and brother had been killed in an IRA attack. Over the next few years, Wright was in and out of prison and continued to work with the UVF. He was proving to be quite a problem to the British Army and the RUC. Wright believed that the RUC had adopted a shoot-to-kill policy and that they were trying to have him killed. It was around 1982 where Wright developed a serious interest in Christianity. He became a committed Christian, but at the same time he refused to denounce violence. Though Ian Paisley was very active during this time as well, Wright wasn't interested in siding with him, as he disagreed with Paisley's foray into the political sphere. Here's Wright speaking about Paisley.
I admire Ian Paisley. I admire his spiritual life, in that he is, whether people choose to believe it or not, he is a spiritual giant. I do disagree with his indulgence in politics. I believe that he would have done himself a great favour not to have involved himself in the things of the world. I do not believe that Dr. Paisley will ever spill blood, not even for Ulster. I believe that he feels his call to God is far more important than his political viewpoints. And so from that point of view, in one sense I would see Dr. Paisley as a blessing. In another sense, I see him as a hindrance. And so I'm certainly not a Paisley, but I do respect him as a man of God.
From 1982 to 1985, Wright travelled around Ireland preaching the Christian gospel, but he was soon drawn back into paramilitary violence in 1985 with the signing of the Anglo-Irish Agreement. I've spoken of this before, but the Anglo-Irish Agreement was an attempt to broker peace in Northern Ireland and end the Troubles. But the agreement did just the opposite of that, and angered the two major sides involved in the conflict. In particular, the Loyalists perceived this agreement as Britain betraying Northern Ireland. There were protests all over Northern Ireland, and in particular Billy's hometown of Portadown. In one such protest, 20-year-old Protestant civilian Keith White was struck with a plastic baton round by the police. He died from his injuries 2 weeks later. This fueled Billy's return to paramilitary activity. Speaking of his decision to return to the violence, Wright said, quote, "I let Christ down. I accept that. I made a conscious decision. I fell on my knees and apologized to God. But I felt contempt for the British government, hatred for the IRA, and longing for justice for Northern Ireland Protestants." After his brief stint away, he was welcomed back into the UVF and immediately set about reorganising the brigade of the UVF known as the Mid-Ulster Brigade. And by 1988, he had eliminated the old guard and had completely restructured the brigade. In 1989, they began a 7-year campaign of violence which targeted random Catholic civilians, as well as IRA members, and struck terror in the hearts of Northern Irish people. Though Wright was in the UVF, many believe that the Mid-Ulster Brigade were a rogue faction and operated against the wishes of the UVF on numerous occasions. They soon became known for shooting young Catholic women in the head at point-blank range. Such was the case in the shooting of 19-year-old Eileen Duffy and 17-year-old Katrina Rennie, who were shot as they were working in a shop. In 1990 and 1991, a number of teenagers were shot dead by the group. 19-year-old Dennis Carville was sitting in a car with his girlfriend in a beauty spot in Oxford Island, Armagh, when gunmen approached his car. They asked him his religion and the name of the local priest. When Carville responded, they told him to look away and shot him in the head at point-blank range. The fear that the gang instilled was immense. No one knew where they would strike next, but everyone knew who was at the centre of operations: Billy Wright. His unit called themselves the Brat Pack, and Wright was soon given the nickname of King Rat, a title which the media started to use to identify him, as they couldn't use his real name for fear of libel. Another operation carried out by the brigade was on the 3rd of March 1991, where three men from the East Tyrone Brigade of the IRA were shot dead outside Boyle's Bar in the village of Kappa. The gunmen then fired through an open window of the pub, killing civilian Thomas Armstrong. This attack proved strategic and dealt a large blow to the command structure of the East Tyrone Brigade of the IRA. I've talked about this group before. They were the ones involved in the Loch Gall ambush. Though Wright was never sentenced for this attack, there were accounts that he was at the scene and reluctant to leave. But there are also eyewitnesses that place Wright at a family function elsewhere on the night of the attack, so the truth will probably never be known. Speaking in later life, Wright said of the violence his brigade inflicted, "There is not a death that I regret. Every single one of them people, with a few exceptions, were directly or indirectly involved in murder." Here's a clip of Ulster Defence Association member Johnny Adair explaining what Wright said to him about taking another person's life.
"I remember the late great Billy Wright, rest in peace. I remember him saying this thing about taking another person's life. He turned around and said, he said, there's three things come with it. He said the first one, which is easy, is pulling the trigger, which is right. Because if you've got a gun on your hand, you're in charge. Nobody's going to... I could go in front of Mike Tyson with a gun. I know there's only going to be one winner. That's me." He said the second thing, he says, "Be prepared to get caught and go to jail for life. Could you live that? But the third and most important bit," he says, "living with it for the rest of your life." And I think he was absolutely right.
The violence from the Mid-Ulster Brigade continued, and in 1992, 32-year-old Kevin McKierney was shot dead as he worked in his family's butcher shop. His uncle was also fatally wounded at the scene. Kevin was targeted because two of his brothers had died while in active service for the IRA a number of years before. One of his brothers was Patrick Kearney, who was killed in the Loch Gall ambush. This spate of killings of the McKierney family was, quote, "The message we were sending out to the IRA was quite clear. If we can't get you, then we will get your nearest and dearest. We hit them where it hurt them most, their own families. In the early 1990s, the IRA in East Tyrone began to hurt. They were now experiencing the same pain as they'd inflicted on the Protestant community for years, and they didn't like a taste of their own medicine." End quote. This bloody campaign continued into the 90s, with the killing of brothers Gerard and Rory Cairns. Then, in August 1994, mother of five, Kathleen O'Hagan, was shot dead. Kathleen was 7 months pregnant when she was killed and was targeted because her husband was a Republican prisoner. Later that year, the UVF announced a ceasefire. This was welcomed in most places except for Mid-Ulster, where Wright and his men believed that they were winning the war. Speaking of the conflict, Wright said, quote, "I met very few brave IRA men, to their own shame. 90% of their senior officers left the battlefield. They ran away, they headed south. That's the nature of them. They want to kill, but they don't want to be killed. The difference between them and us is that loyalists have nowhere to run. At the end of this phase of the campaign, it appears that all the big names within terrorism were loyalists. I was here all along, I never moved from home, and I'm staying here." By 1994, the IRA had tried to kill Wright a number of times, and had been unsuccessful. His car had been booby-trapped twice, once a civilian saw it occurring and warned him, the other time the device went off but only injured him. As well as that, two IRA gunmen staked out his house and planned to shoot him, but gave up after 48 hours without him showing up. It was also around this time that Wright began questioning the UVF. He disagreed with their ceasefire and believed that the route that they were taking was too Marxist for the working-class loyalist. The Drumcree standoff in 1996 would prove to be a pivotal moment in the relationship between Billy Wright and the UVF. In Drumcree, every year, the Orange Order, who are a unionist fraternal group, would march a traditional route through the town. This route would pass through a largely Catholic area, and the Catholics living there saw this march as sectarian and supremacist, and sought to have it banned from passing through their area. Wright was unhappy that the local police, the RUC, were siding with the Catholics and preventing the march from going ahead, so he led a number of people to Drumcree to support the Orange Order. He expected the UVF to come along and show their support too, but they decided not to be involved, which further angered Billy. Things came to a head on July 9, 1996, when Catholic taxi driver Michael McGoldrick was found dead in his taxi after being shot 5 times in the head. Some sources I read claimed that there was a loyalist plan to kidnap a number of Catholic taxi drivers in and around Drumcree and then drop them off in the middle of nowhere, with the idea that if the Protestants can't march, then the Catholics shouldn't be allowed to work. But it seems this plan went wrong with the killing of McGoldrick. There is speculation that Wright ordered this execution to try and make it appear that the UVF had sanctioned the attack. The UVF were concerned about the growing support for Wright that was happening all over Northern Ireland, and this show of force at Drumcree illustrated how influential he was becoming. It was 1996. The UVF was in the middle of a ceasefire and trying to move away from paramilitary activity and towards the political process. Billy Wright and the Mid-Ulster Brigade were jeopardising that. On August 2nd, Wright and the Brigade were stood down by the UVF. Wright was expelled by the group and given 72 hours to leave Northern Ireland or face execution. Wright ignored this demand and decided to remain in Portadown. A mass rally of his supporters happened a few days later, where Wright stood in front of the crowd and said, quote, "I will not be leaving Ulster. I will not change my mind about what I believe is happening in Ulster. But all I would like to say is that it has broken my heart that fellow loyalists would turn their guns on me, and I have to ask them, for whom are you doing it?" Here's a clip of a reporter questioning Wright about why he wanted to continue an armed campaign instead of accepting a peace process.
"What would be the point now in loyalists thinking of taking up the gun? Well, they can't sit idly by and allow their people to be murdered and allow political leverage to be gained from violence. It is not of their choice, and they certainly do not desire it, but nevertheless they're duty bound to protect their people and their country.
Even if it means more deaths of innocent people?
Even if it means their deaths.
Because there were incidents involving loyalist paramilitaries where it was just innocent Catholic people who were being singled out.
Well, I'm on record as stating that I do not agree, and I don't believe the leadership would agree, that innocent nationalists should lose their lives in any conflict. However, I'm on record that during the war, I support the right of the loyalist people to defend themselves and to take action, direct action against the army.
Even if that means the deaths of innocent people in a pub or wherever.
Well, the government has proved time and time again that it's incapable of protecting the lives of the unionist people. Now, it's quite clear that the unionists desire peace. But if they've begun down in the street and are completely rubbed off them, surely they as a nation have the right to defend themselves and to protect their property, as any other nation has."
Once kicked out of the UVF, Wright then set about creating his own paramilitary organisation, which became known as the Loyalist Volunteer Force, or LVF for short. In this way, you didn't just have Republican fighting Loyalist, now we have two Loyalist paramilitary organisations who were rivals. The LVF was much smaller than the UVF, but they were made up of ex-UVF members who had absolute faith in Billy. The LVF published their objectives, which were, quote, "The use of the Ulster conflict as a crucible for far-reaching, fundamental and decisive change in the United Kingdom's constitution. To restore Ulster's right to self-determination. To end Irish nationalist aggression against Ulster in whatever form. To end all forms of Irish interference in Ulster's international affairs. To thwart the creation and implementation of any all-Ireland, all-Ireland political superstructures, regardless of the powers vested in such institutions. And finally, to defeat the campaign of de-Britishisation and Gaelicisation of Ulster's daily life." Here's a clip of Wright responding when asked by a reporter if he's leaving the country.
"I will not believe in Northern Ireland. I have took a stand on a principle that I have the right, the absolute right, to hold a viewpoint that 97% of the unionist community holds."
His time as leader of the LVF wouldn't last long, as Wright was arrested and imprisoned on March 7th, 1997 for two offences, for committing an act with intent to pervert the course of justice and making threats against the life of a woman, Gwen Reid. For this, he was sentenced to 8 years in prison, which some believe was very high. At the same time, Wright had been a thorn in the side of the RUC and British Army for many years, so there is speculation that this lengthy imprisonment would have suited them. He ended up back in May's prison again, where he demanded there to be an individual section of the prison for LVF members. While in prison, he continued to direct the LVF, and membership actually increased on the outside. Wright was well aware that there were many prisoners in close proximity to him who wanted him dead. The Irish National Liberation Army, or INLA, is an Irish Republican Socialist paramilitary group which is much smaller than the IRA, but still responsible for a number of bombings and assassinations during the Troubles. While Wright was imprisoned, a number of groups were engaged in a ceasefire, including the Provisional IRA, the UVF, and the UDA. The problem was that the LVF and the INLA were not. And this is something which caused concern amongst prison officers. Because of this, great efforts were made to ensure that the two groups never had any contact with each other and that they were kept in separate wings of the same H-block. It was Saturday, December 27th, 1998. Around 9:30 a.m. in the morning, and Wright was scheduled to meet his then-girlfriend Eleanor in the prison. When she arrived, an officer shouted down the wing of Billy's block to let him know. This was common practice, as it saved the officers walking down to the cells. But it also alerted the INLA men who were lying in wait. One such man, John McWilliams, was pretending to paint a mural in a nearby wing and waiting to raise the signal. John then signalled to the two other INLA men. Wright came out of his wing and got into a prison van, and the van started to drive across the courtyard to the gate. At the same time, three INLA men began their operation. They were separated from the courtyard by a metal fence, which had been cut earlier. They then went through the fence and climbed up onto the roof before jumping down into the courtyard, which contained the van which Wright was in. He was sitting in the back of the van, idly chatting to a fellow inmate about, and I quote, "the true meaning of Christmas," when the three men ran out in front of the van. The men were Christopher McWilliams, John Glennon, and John Kennaway. Two of the men were armed, and neither the driver of the van nor the prison officer in the back were. The driver of the van moved to escape, but the alarm had sounded and the exit gates automatically shut, trapping the van in the courtyard. McWilliams opened up the side door of the van and shouted, "Armed INLA volunteers," before pointing his gun into the van. There were three in the back of the van, Wright, an inmate, and a prison officer. The inmate and prison officer dropped to the floor to protect themselves, whereas Wright stood up and started kicking out at McWilliams and fighting for his life. McWilliams began shooting at Wright, and seven shots hit him at point-blank range. It was the last bullet that fatally injured him, having pierced his heart, and he was pronounced dead shortly after. Directly after the attack, the three gunmen returned to their cell and requested to speak to a chaplain, before surrendering their weapons and handing over a statement which read, "Billy Wright was executed for one reason and one reason only, and that was for directing and waging his campaign of terror against the nationalist people from his prison cell in Lankesh." The response on the outside was one of rage and anger. LVF gunmen opened fire on a Catholic disco and a number of other Catholic civilians were killed to avenge for his death. Eventually, Wright's father, David, pleaded to the LVF to stop the violence. In Portadown, Wright's body was displayed and LVF gunmen kept a constant vigil at his side before his funeral took place on December 30th, where he was given a full paramilitary funeral. Thousands of mourners attended the funeral, and shops and businesses around Portadown were either ordered to close or did so as a sign of respect to Billy. Many people couldn't understand how a man could be executed in what was supposed to be Europe's most secure prison by armed prisoners. Wright's father, David, was convinced that there had to be some form of collusion between prison officers and the INLA, and believed that there were some suspicious circumstances on the day. Here's just a few questions that were raised from the day. How did the two guns get smuggled into the prison? Prisoners usually smuggled goods in their rectum, but these guns would have been too large for that. John Kennaway claimed that they were smuggled in nappies or diapers. There should have been a guard in a nearby watchtower, but he had been ordered to stand down just minutes before the attack, so why was he stood down? A visiting list had been given out to prisoners one day before Billy's death, with details of who was getting visitors the next day. This was the first time that INLA and LVF prisoners were included on each other's lists, which would have notified them that Billy was expecting a visitor. The LVF went on to issue a statement calling all these factors into question. In response, and to prove that it was a lone attack, without any form of police collusion, the INLA released a very thorough account of the sequence of events leading up to the killing. For their role in the killing of Billy Wright, the three men received lengthy prison sentences, but were released less than 2 years later under the terms of the Good Friday Agreement. An inquiry into Wright's killing was held in 2005, which lasted for 5 years and cost around £30 million. The inquiry found major failings in the security of the prison, but overall no evidence of collusion. These findings were denounced by Wright's father, who said it was a total whitewash and a failure to get at the truth. Wright became a cult icon and a hero in the eyes of hardline loyalists and the ones who didn't support the peace process in Northern Ireland, and he remains so. His most devout followers have tattoos of his face on their body, and there were many murals dedicated to him around Portadown, with some still visible today. After Wright's death, the LVF continued, with Mark Fulton at the helm. In the year 2000, they began a feud with the UVF, which led to a number of killings. The LVF were also implicated in having ties to the English neo-Nazi group Combat 18. There have been other claims that Billy Wright was a medium-sized ecstasy dealer, or that he was a tout and in bed with the British government, but these claims have never been proven. For some, Wright will be remembered as a martyr who died for the cause that he was so attached to. For others, he was a ruthless killer, and though he wasn't directly implicated in many killings, he was definitely the one pulling the strings. Thanks, and see you next time.